science of toxic stress, and in routine ACE screening as a critical part of regular medical care. In 2005, she had stumbled on Felidi and Anda's research while trying to understand the role of childhood trauma in addiction treatment. Around the same time, Nancy also discovered the work of the Harvard Center on the Developing Child, which clarified for her the scientific basis for using ACEs to assess toxic stress. At the time, her job was to identify individuals and organizations doing important work in the fields of child development, mental health, and addiction. When she first read the ACE study, she experienced a jolt of understanding of the deep connections between each of the fields she was so passionate about. At the time, Mannix and her team observed that most addiction treatment was grounded in the belief that clinical work should focus on the patient's future, which meant that clinicians didn't want to spend too much time on their patient's past. Interventions were disparate and based on individual diagnoses. The systems that were supposed to help patients heal were fragmented. Mannix recalled the case of a 17-year-old girl with an eating disorder and a cocaine addiction who was sexually acting out. The fact that these behaviors might all be symptoms of a single underlying root cause wasn't on anyone's radar screen. So she was sent to rehab for the drug problem, sent to a separate clinic for the eating disorder, and counseled about the dangers of risky sex. No one realized that the severe adversity the young woman had experienced as a child might be driving her symptoms, and none of the interventions were particularly effective. Mannix and her team set out to change all that. They began by bringing a group of addiction treatment providers together with patients to talk about how the system could better serve clients. Some providers were receptive, but others pushed back defensively, insisting that they were the experts and they provided excellent care. These patients were simply failing treatment. So Mannix made it her mission to bring the science of ACEs to Alberta. She held what she called an initial catalytic convening in the town of Red Deer, inviting clinicians, academics, policymakers, and education experts. She recruited the leading experts in the field of toxic stress to lay out the latest science and created a straightforward and understandable story to explain the impact of early adversity on brain development. This convening launched a multi-year strategy to bring decision makers and practitioners together with scientists to understand ACEs and the emerging science. As part of this process, researchers at the University of Calgary launched a study, recruiting over 4,000 patients from primary care clinics and asking about ACEs as well as health status and mental health measures. Much like the original ACE study, the population was 83% Caucasian and 82% college educated. What the researchers found was that the numbers fell within a few percentage points of Felidi and Anda's results, demonstrating that Alberta was as affected by ACEs as anywhere else. People with high ACEs were, again, shown to be at much higher risk for depression and anxiety, and also to have greater risk of asthma, autoimmune disease, food allergies, cardiac disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, migraines, fibromyalgia, reflux disease, chronic bronchitis, stomach ulcers, and the list goes on. People were astounded to see the profound effect of ACEs that had previously gone unrecognized in their communities. After they got over their shock, they came together to find solutions. Doctors and health programs began regularly screening for ACEs in both outpatient clinics and inpatients, and policymakers put forth contract requirements with agencies receiving government funding to be competent in the brain science. The Alberta Family Wellness Initiative, as it would come to be called, made its mark on Canada by turning what we know about early adversity and health into what we do in practice and service delivery. So on this day, Nancy Mannix was eager to rebut the over-reliance on neuroscience bias, eager to proselytize for competency in the science and routine ACE screening, and eager to insist on mobilizing the powers that be in support of better systems to create better care. Jeanette and Nancy and I had all come via different paths, but we had arrived in the same place and were focusing on the same source of the problem. Standing with them, I could feel the beginnings of a true public health response coming together. But the day's contentious conversation had illuminated yet another point of resistance. While I had expressed my opinion that primary care clinics were the ideal place for ACE screening, I had also said that enough kids had been sent to my clinic by teachers requesting a diagnosis of ADHD and medications, that I knew that the doctor's office wasn't the only place that needed fundamental understanding of toxic stress. This statement opened a hornet's nest. One woman in particular wondered, as I heard later, whether ACE screening in schools could be used to label low-income kids and stigmatize them even further. Whenever I had a question concerning ACEs and education, I knew whom to turn to, fellow physician and ACE trailblazer, Dr. Pamela Cantor. Her organization, Turnaround for Children, was leading the charge to bring the science of ACEs and toxic stress into schools. Turnaround has been at it for over a decade, but Dr. Cantor herself has been working with kids affected by ACEs for a lot longer than that. A psychiatrist by training, she specialized in child mental health and gravitated towards treating kids exposed to trauma. She had developed what she called a Robin Hood practice. As a member of the faculty at Cornell Medical School, she practiced on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and in the South Bronx. Working at one clinic paid the bills so she could work at the other. Unsurprisingly, to me anyways, the common thread that she saw between her work in both communities was exposure to ACEs. Over the years, she became more and more involved in research and advocacy that focused on the developmental disruptions caused by trauma, which is why on September 11th, 2001, when the most acute trauma the United States had experienced since Pearl Harbor hit, New York City came calling. Dr. Cantor was asked to co-chair a partnership commissioned by the city's Department of Education and help launch a study to investigate the traumatic effects of 9/11 on New York City's public school children. The partnership worked with researchers from Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health, and together, they undertook what was at the time the largest epidemiological study of an urban public education system from a mental health perspective. The common sense hypothesis going into the study was that kids in schools closest to ground zero would be the most affected and would naturally need the most help. The data came in the form of maps on huge sheets of tracing paper that the research team could overlay to see the alignment between trauma symptoms and the various neighborhoods relative to ground zero. As they lay sheet after sheet over each other, the team found that the data showed a totally different picture than any of them had expected. The distribution of trauma symptoms was not clustered around ground zero, which were largely middle-class neighborhoods. Instead, the greatest groupings of trauma symptoms corresponded strikingly with the communities in deepest poverty. The next page of the map revealed that the areas that were most affected were also the communities that had the fewest resources. Dr. Cantor's response to the data was to get out into the schools and meet the actual children represented by those dots on a map. The first place she visited was an elementary school in Washington Heights, a neighborhood on the border of Harlem. As she entered the school, Dr. Cantor noted that the hallway to the huge, looming building was dark. Standing there was a mother, clutching the hand of her little girl. There were no signs of childlike industry, no drawings of families or smiling macaroni faces glued to paper plates. Instead, there was a feeling of fear and chaos. It was as if no one was in charge. The halls were filled with kids running and yelling. There was a group of kids fighting in the hallway, big kids. It was a shock to Dr. Cantor the first time she saw it, but as she visited more and more schools, she learned that it was typical for schools like this to contain middle school age kids who had been held back. They were 12, 13, and 14 years old, big kids, fighting in the hallways right next to kindergarten classrooms. She couldn't help but imagine how the little kids must have felt navigating the hallways of that school every day. When Dr. Cantor was finally escorted to a classroom, she observed kids making paper airplanes and fooling around, supervised by teachers who looked completely unable to manage their students or control what was going on around them. There seemed to be little or no learning going on. What the study eventually concluded, after many visits to schools across the city and hours of conversation, was best illustrated by one of the youngest participants. A 5-year-old boy from Harlem was asked to draw a picture of his feelings about 9/11. When he handed it to Dr. Cantor, she looked first for what she had come to expect, 2 iconic smoking towers. They were in the drawing, but only as 2 tiny structures in the distance. In the foreground, and much bigger, were 2 stick figure children pointing guns at each other. This picture demonstrated with heartbreaking clarity that to the kids showing the most signs of trauma, 9/11 was only a trigger. 2 curlicues of smoke on the horizon. The origin of their symptoms was not the acute trauma of 9/11. It was the clear and present danger of their everyday lives. The chronic stress of walking to school through a crime-ridden neighborhood in the morning and then feeling unsafe in school all day meant that the kids in the deepest poverty lived in a state of constant alert. Dr. Cantor's experience working with children on both sides of town cued her into a critical realization. The communities near Ground Zero were equipped with more resources, which meant the adults were far more able to act as effective buffers, keeping the kids' stress out of the toxic zone and into the realm of tolerable. Whether it was a teacher, a religious leader, a grandparent, or a coach, the children closer to Ground Zero had many more sources of buffering that could help stabilize them in moments of acute trauma, even if it was severe. What Dr. Cantor saw through the research was that poverty itself reduces the resources available to even caring, dedicated parents to be effective buffers for their kids. Not only were children in poverty experiencing a greater incidence of trauma, they were more likely to develop toxic stress because their source of buffering was constrained by the daily existential stresses that families were under. That was what was affecting their ability to thrive and learn in school. And that was the insight that drove Dr. Cantor to leave her practice and dedicate herself to creating solutions that could help very vulnerable children. When she first set foot in the elementary school in Washington Heights, Dr. Cantor's immediate reaction was burning outrage. As a psychiatrist, she recognized the symptoms of trauma all around her. It wasn't one or two kids. It was the entire school. When people hear the word trauma, they often think it represents a small percentage of children requiring services in a typical high-need school setting, somewhere around 10 to 15% of kids. That was what Dr. Cantor once believed. What she came to learn, after visiting many high-need schools, was that while there might be a relatively small percentage of kids who needed individualized mental health services, the students who required something beyond a traditional educational environment in order to be able to be ready and engaged in learning was much, much larger. Turnaround for Children was founded after 9/11 with a recognition that while most schools inherently acknowledge the importance of mobilizing resources in response to acute traumas, they simply aren't set up to address the insidious ways in which the day-to-day onslaught of chronic adversity undermines learning. First, the organization had to educate people about the connection between adversity and academic performance. Despite all the research, Dr. Cantor and her team still found that this wasn't always intuitive for many educators. Next, Turnaround had to figure out how to support schools in designing practices and interventions that worked for kids dealing with the impact of stress to improve their learning outcomes. No easy task. As a physician, Dr. Cantor approached the problem via the neurobiology of adversity. In order to be able to pay attention and learn in school, a kid needed to be able to engage his prefrontal cortex, the conductor, which meant the amygdala alarm had to be silent. Safety and stability would be key components to the solution. But how could Turnaround create safety and stability in the classroom when kids were bringing these stressful experiences from home and the community into the classroom with them, causing problems and challenges for teachers and fellow students? Dr. Cantor and her team knew that for many of the kids they were serving, the amygdala alarm was always on high alert, and the cortisol thermostat was overheating. They also knew that the natural antidote to toxic stress, having a well-regulated caregiver who could buffer the stress response, was often in very short supply. Turnaround began using the science to inform school practices and policies. They placed mental health professionals and social workers in schools, building systems of support that families could easily plug into. Turnaround invested in training every adult in the school environment, from the leadership to the guidance staff to every single teacher, because they recognized that the traumatic effects of adversity cross an entire school building. They observed that one child in a classroom with attentional and behavioral challenges will often disrupt a lesson, but 30 children with these kinds of struggles can trigger a tinderbox effect, shutting down learning for everyone. One of the biggest challenges for many schools was discipline, how to balance the safety of the school community with the needs of each individual child. The traditional model of school discipline was reactive and punitive. You do X, the consequence is suspension or expulsion. And that meant a lot of kids were losing valuable time in the classroom. Turnaround developed strategies aimed to work with a student's biology instead of against it by first addressing the dysregulated stress response and then dealing with the issue at hand. This could be something as simple as offering a student a better choice for dealing with a stressful moment, such as retreating to a space reserved for quiet reflection, or prompting a student with a silent signal to count to 10 and breathe deeply. Their approach had a profound impact on school culture. Across turnaround partner schools, from 2011 to 2014, suspensions were cut in half. Measurements of classroom climate, productivity, and engagement jumped by over 20%, and severe incidents declined by 42%. Dr. Cantor and her team expanded turnaround to more cities, bringing their model from New York to Washington, D.C., and then to Newark. Still, they found themselves struggling with one especially frustrating challenge. All of the science suggested that the positive outcomes they were seeing should pave the way for improved learning. But despite all the wins on school culture and climate, test scores remained surprisingly stubborn. They racked their brains for what they could be missing. They met with school leaders, looked at their data, and went to educational conferences to learn from others' best practices. The breakthrough, from Dr. Cantor's perspective, ultimately came with a shift in how they looked at solutions. She saw that educators often lifted up one practice as the solution to the problem. After being in the education world for 15 years, Dr. Cantor had seen how accountability and measurement was now the thing, how expectation was the thing, how a great teacher in every classroom was the thing. It hit her that in medicine, she hadn't been trained to ask, "What is the thing?" Her training told her to ask herself, "What explains the symptoms we're seeing?" And usually, the answer was more complicated than just one thing. She realized that turnaround had to apply interventions based on a comprehensive understanding of the problem. It was tremendously important for kids to go to a school where they felt physically and emotionally safe. Check. It was also really important for kids to develop their readiness for learning, because the exposure to adversity affected the skills that were involved in learning readiness. Check. We have that too. Many school systems were profoundly influenced by the realization that when it comes to student success, teaching things like resilience and grit can be just as important as teaching math and science. Dr. Cantor and her team went one step further. The developmental neuroscience suggested that before kids could learn grit and resilience, or math and science for that matter, they needed a basic foundation in healthy attachment, stress management, and self-regulation. Healthy attachment is what Dr. Lieberman and Dr. Rentschler worked so hard on with Charlene and Nia. When it goes right, healthy attachment begins at birth and forms the basis from which we all learn to trust and relate to one another. For many children, growing up in poverty, in families stressed by economic and other insecurities, healthy attachment and stable, nurturing experiences were much more challenging. Whether it was chaos at home, violence in the community, the crushing weight of poverty, or the fog of drugs, alcohol, and mental illness, families often faced overwhelming challenges in providing safety and security for their children. Dr. Cantor realized that they had created a model built on a foundation that many of their students never got, which is why their model was only partially effective. They figured out that when it came to educational success, the key was not just to provide the right ingredients, But like Tyrone's tadpoles, the timing, sequencing, and dosage of these ingredients was critical. So Turnaround came up with a framework it called Building Blocks for Learning that worked to develop in children the foundational skills of attachment, stress management, and self-regulation, and then layered on the other skills for learning on top. By ensuring the development of these skills in an order that makes sense for learners' biology, Turnaround was building on decades of neuroscience, telling us that it's not enough to step on the gas by providing enriched environments to support learning for children. You also have to release the brake, the inhibitory effect of the amygdala on cognitive function, by supporting attachment, stress management, and self-regulation. In doing so, Turnaround may finally be able to crack the notoriously difficult test scores problems for kids living with adversity. Their partner schools in the Bronx are beginning to see net gains in scores in math and language arts that outpace the gains of other schools in the district. Far from stigmatizing and singling out kids with ACEs, Turnaround embraces an approach that simply identifies where a student is on the developmental trajectory and uses the science of toxic stress to help get that child back on track. Knowing whether a kid's development is stuck because of exposure to ACEs is fundamental to figuring out where to start in the classroom. Dr. Cantor's description of her schools was consistent with everything I knew about toxic stress. I thought about my kids in Bayview, the ones whose learning and behavior problems in their classes was so often severe. It hit me that ACEs weren't just at the root of a public health crisis in America. They were at the root of our public education crisis as well. It was clear that while ACEs might be a health crisis with a medical problem at its root, its effects ripple out far beyond our biology. Toxic stress affects how we learn, how we parent, how we react at home and at work, and what we create in our communities. It affects our children, our earning potential, and the very ideas we have about what we're capable of. What starts out in the wiring of one brain cell to another ultimately affects all of the cells of our society, from our families to our schools to our workplaces to our jails. Nancy Mannix, Jeanette Pye Espinosa, and Pam Cantor were taking this new understanding and integrating it into their work in ways that were creating breakthroughs for the communities that they served. Despite the pushback and the naysaying, these women were on the vanguard of a movement, slowly but surely bringing ACE-informed approaches to scale. I made a mental note to stay in touch with these women, to learn from their successes and failures, and support and encourage them in any way that I could. I felt heartened to see the movement gaining traction beyond the field of pediatrics and branching out to the beginnings of a true public health movement. Still, I felt unsettled. It was unnerving how quickly the conversation at the conference had gone sideways. I knew that what I really needed to understand about that conference was, why the hateration? A few weeks later, I found myself once again packing up my breast pump to attend yet another conference that I just couldn't miss. This one, hosted by the White House and the Gates Foundation, was being held at the University of California, San Francisco, which meant that at least I didn't have very far to travel. As I handed Greybu to my husband with a kiss and then stepped out the door, I found myself looking forward to this conference more than I had for almost any other in recent memory. I wasn't speaking, which felt a little bit like a luxury. I could just sit back and soak up all the exciting new research and delicious data. The agenda of the Precision Public Health Summit was to bring everyone together to discuss how precision medicine could be used in the public health arena to level the playing field in the critical first 1,000 days of a child's life. In other words, it was right up my alley. The discussion was wide-ranging, but a big theme throughout was the importance of partnerships between scientists and the communities they are trying to help. One of the speakers from the community partner side of things was Janae Johnson, the director of the Black Infant Health Program, BIH, in San Francisco. The organization's mission is to improve maternal and infant health in African American communities, which meant our paths had naturally crossed. Even before the Bayview Clinic opened, Janae recruited me to lead a class on common health concerns for babies that BIH hosted at the Bayview YMCA. All these years later, I was happy to see BIH's wonderful work represented at the summit. But soon, as someone who is pretty conversant in the worlds of both science and community, I noticed a natural tension playing out in front of me. The researchers and statisticians who sat beside Janae talked about biomarkers and data sets, about the difficulties of data collection and privacy. Janae, however, spoke passionately about the moms and babies she worked with and the day-to-day reality of poverty and social adversity in the community. She talked about respect for Black women, clapping her hands as she repeated, "Respect! Respect! Respect!" emphasizing each syllable and raising her voice with each clap. To the research scientist, numbers are people. To a person who serves vulnerable families, numbers distract from the real experience. As she began to talk to the audience, the emotion in her voice made the room of over 300 scientists feel very, very small. Janae talked about a mother who showed up to a program one evening with all of her possessions in a suitcase and a baby on her hip because she had nowhere to spend the night. Her voice rose with pain and anger as she talked about how the science was failing the people she worked with by not putting them at the center of the work. "What's the serum for helping a community stay together and not be dismantled? I have families that now commute back to my program from Antioch, 45 miles away. What's the serum for that? Dr. Martin Luther King told us that it does not cost America anything to have me drink at the same water fountain as you. It does not cost America anything to have me sit at the front of the bus. But it is going to cost something to make sure that we have educational equality, equality in jobs, housing. So we are gathered here, and this is a beautiful gathering, but we are missing a whole other group of people. Because to manage stress, the stress that my clients come into the office with, I don't have a serum. There's no pill. There's no research question to help me help them. We keep talking about stress, stress, stress. And let's study, study, study. When the axiology of Black people is relationship. We all know that. We need to bring them up on the agenda and bring other people into the space, especially the people that this impacts. We're at meeting 500 that I've been to, brother, and they are not here." The room remained silent for a moment, and in that small slice of time, a surge of conflicting emotions overcame me. I felt Janae's anger about the lack of diversity in the conversation and her heartbreak for the young mother who had nowhere to go. I agreed with much of what she had said, but her statement that the people affected by stress weren't here was dead wrong. I knew that for a fact. For a split second, my husband's face flashed in my mind. His expression was taut with alarm. His jaw clenched. He looked menacing in a way I'd never seen him before. It was 2014, before Grebu was born, and we were at Lake Tahoe in Nevada with the kids waiting for a table at a restaurant. I remember rounding the corner returning from the restroom and catching a glimpse of my husband. His appearance was alarming. I took in every detail of the scene as if it were playing out in slow motion. His body was tight as a drawn bow, full of potential energy that looked like it was about to become kinetic. His fists clenched and unclenched. I could see the fat, worm-like veins standing out on his forearms. His eyes, shifting back and forth, were trained on our three rowdy black boys playing in their usual oblivious manner on the bench in front of the restaurant. Kingston, only 2 years old at the time, was trying to push my twin stepsons, Petros and Paulos, both 11, off the bench. He was laughing and shoving, and they were doing their best to goad him into showing his fiercest feats of strength. Then Arno's eyes led me to look just past them to two burly Caucasian men with shaved heads, steel-toe boots, and dark gray-blue tattoos snaking up their necks. The men were glowering at our sons. I recognized immediately that Arno was in full fight-or-flight mode, and for a second, I thought my own heart might stop. Just then, the hostess called our name, giving us a good reason to get away from the two human bears in the forest. But the image of my husband in that moment, bare-knuckled and ready to brawl as he watched the men glaring at his kids, is burned in my mind for two reasons. One is that, as the father of black children, Arno has an additional risk factor for stress. When you're black or brown and living in America, there are more threats and stressors inherent in your experience. In other words, you live in a part of the forest where there are a lot more bears. Race is never easy to talk about, but exposure is exposure is exposure. That was a big part of what Janae had been saying, and she was right. But the other reason I will never forget that moment in Tahoe is a thing I wished I could share with Janae. While he does have black kids, my husband is white. In fact, my sweetheart, Whitey McWhiterson, the mayor of Caucasia, as I affectionately call him, is both white and a successful CEO. He sits on the top of the socioeconomic food chain. If you were to look up the man in the dictionary, you'd see a picture of my husband. My two stepsons are adopted. Their complexion is darker than mine, while Kingston is a creamy caramel. Undoubtedly, the two men snarling at our kids had no idea that they were standing just a few feet from their father. But in that moment, Arno was just a dad whose kids were being threatened. What I saw was a profound example of the intersection of biology and society. The stress response mechanism is hardwired into all of us. Threat equals reaction, and it doesn't matter if the threat is in the form of a Confederate flag tattoo or a strapping grizzly. The same biological mechanism is engaged. What I felt Janae wasn't seeing was that while my kids and hers might have stress response triggering experiences because of their race, poor white kids living in Appalachia also have triggering experiences. Think about it like this. We all live in a forest with different kinds of bears. There's a large group of bears that populate the part of the forest called poverty. And if you live there, you're going to see a whole lot of bears. There's also a part of the forest called race, where a different cluster of bears hang out. And there's another bear neighborhood called violence. If you live near any of these bear dens, your stress response system is going to be affected. But here's the important part. It's affected in the same way, no matter which bear you tango with. Unfortunately, a lot of people, like my patients, live in a place in the forest where the neighborhoods of poverty, race, and violence overlap. And for them, it's wall to wall to wall bears. But there are also a lot of bears that live in the neighborhoods of parental mental illness and divorce and addiction, which is why I reacted so strongly to the last part of Janae's statement. Some of the people that this impacts were in the room. That's why we need to collect broad swaths of data, because public health scale solutions require us to identify and measure toxic stress in everyone, not just one group of people. We are not going to make a dent in this problem by creating solutions for just one community. Suddenly, as I sat listening to Janae, something inside me shifted. It was as if someone had flipped a switch. This was it. This was precisely the root of so much of the emotional blockage around ACEs that I had encountered. It was why those folks in New York got so riled up so quickly about the thought of their kids being stigmatized by screening. And right now, the anxiety and pain was etched on Janae's face. What about us? She seemed to be saying. What does all this do for the pain and suffering in my community? That sentiment is both totally understandable. The pain and suffering of the African American community is one of our country's deepest unhealed wounds, and exactly what will keep us running in place for years to come. I stood up, trembling. With the hush in the room, I didn't need a microphone. As I talked, I could hear my voice shaking. I may have been speaking to Janae and the others in the room at that moment, but it felt more like I was screaming on the edge of a canyon, hoping the echo would carry for miles. I think that all of us are here in this room because we are trying to come up with solutions for the entire population. Some of it has to do with payment for mental health services, so that the parents of my patients who have mental health disorders can get good enough care, so that they can hold down a job, so that they can keep their children in housing. I believe that when we make the connection between adversity and only the people you are seeing and I am seeing every day, our stories are not enough. We need to connect our stories with the science and the data. My voice rose. I could hear my T's becoming more crisp, my A's opening up, and my cans turning into cans as the lilt of my childhood Patois dialect undercut my attempt at composure. Tears welled up and spilled down my face. It is not just that it doesn't cost America anything for us to drink at the same water fountain. We must show that it costs America billions of dollars in cardiovascular disease and cancer and housing and education for us to drink from different water fountains. The room erupted with applause. We need to make that argument. We must explain to every person that if they are in Appalachia, if they are living in Middle America, if they are living in Kentucky and they believe that they have it hard, we must make sure that every single person knows that they can get strong solutions for poor white folks, for the parent who brought her child and her suitcases to you, that we are in a united struggle about the effects of adversity on the developing brains and bodies of children. And when we can all get behind that, then we will have solutions that will lift everybody up. I sat down, trembling with emotion. When Dr. Clark handed me Dr. Felitti's paper almost 10 years earlier, I had been able to pull the pieces together and recognize what was really going on with my patients. In that moment at UCSF, my heart still racing, I realized that I had just had a second, very public, epiphany. Why were people so resistant to the science of adversity and to giving the basic fact of our biology a name and a number? Because when you bring it down to the level of cells, the level of biological mechanisms, then it is about all of us. We are all equally susceptible and equally in need of help when adversity strikes. And that is what a lot of folks don't want to hear. Some want to stand back and pretend that this is just a poor person problem. Others take fierce ownership of the problem and say, this is killing my community. But what they also mean is, it's killing my people more than yours. In rural white communities, the story is about loss of living wage work and the fallout from rampant drug use. In immigrant communities, it's about discrimination and the fear of forever being separated from loved ones at a moment's notice. In African American communities, it's about the legacy of centuries of inhuman treatment that persists to this day. It's about boys being at risk when they're playing on a bench or walking home from the store wearing a hoodie. In Native American communities, it's about the obliteration of land and culture and the legacy of dislocation. But everyone is really saying the same thing. I am suffering. It's easy to get stuck on your own suffering because naturally it's what affects you most. But that's exactly the mentality that is killing black people, white people, and all people. It perpetuates the problem by framing it in terms of us versus them. Either we get ahead or they get ahead. That leads quickly to a fight for resources that fragments efforts to solve the same damn problem. What I was trying to communicate to Janae and to everyone in the room was that this very human instinct toward tribalism was why we needed science. That was why we needed every researcher, data cruncher, and scientist in that room. Because the science shows that it's not us against them. In fact, we all share a common enemy. And that common enemy is childhood adversity. The approach to treatment for the homeless child, standing with her mom, holding their bags at a Black Infant Health Program meeting, is the same as the approach you use for family in Pennsylvania, where the dad hasn't worked in 5 years because the plant closed down, and for the little girl in rural China, whose mother had to leave her to find work in Beijing, and for the families in Montenegro and Serbia who lived through the Civil War. It's the same fundamental approach to treatment for us all. If we begin to understand that, then maybe we can stop being so balkanized in our response to the problem and be able to come up with solutions that work for everyone. Because as my dad used to say in his Jamaican patois,
"That rising tide, she lift up all the boats, man."
Chapter 12. Listerine. It was 1 p.m. on the nose when I strode into the clinic, the last few bites of my lunch in a brown, compostable to-go box. I thought I had a few minutes to spare before my first patient of the afternoon, but as I passed the reception desk, Nurse Mark flagged me down. "Your first patient is roomed and ready," he said, handing me a printout of my notes from the previous visit, as well as all the new paperwork my patient had completed for today's appointment. They were early, so I put them in the butterfly room. "Got it," I replied, scampering off to the physician's office to quickly throw on my white coat and grab my stethoscope. I couldn't help but smile to myself. It had been 10 years since we opened the Bayview Child Health Center. I couldn't have imagined in 2007 that in 2017 we would still be in Bayview, that I would still be here. I certainly wouldn't have dreamed that the Bayview Clinic would have inspired the creation of the Center for Youth Wellness, or that the two organizations would be working side by side, not only to screen every child for ACEs and provide comprehensive care, but also to share our tools, models, and clinical insights with doctors around the world. As things evolved, the one constant was the dedicated and caring nature of our staff. When Nurse Mark had come on, he took over the day-to-day management of the clinic, which meant that although I was the founding physician, he ran the show. I was taking my orders from him. A few minutes later, after my standard knock-knock, I stepped through the door of the butterfly room and into what remained, by far, my favorite part of the week, seeing patients. The butterfly room is named for the hundreds of little butterfly decals all over the walls, thoughtfully placed to make it feel as if they're all flying towards some beautiful, invisible flowers down the hall. When the Bayview Clinic moved into the Center for Youth Wellness building in 2013, the staff had taken pains to ensure that our new space was as welcoming and kid-friendly as the old one. Every room was decorated with dozens of wall decals, each in a different animal theme. There was the jungle room, the dinosaur room, the safari room, the under-the-sea room, and the Farmville room. But the butterfly room was definitely my fave. When I first saw it, it had taken my breath away. Most of the butterflies were flat stickers on the wall, but a few, up in the corner above the sink, were in 3D, their pink and purple wings protruding as if to say, "We're real." My 16-year-old patient was perched on the exam table, his eyes glued to his phone. He was busy whipping out a text message or Instagramming or Snapchatting or whatever 16-year-olds are doing with their phones these days. His mother was sitting in the chair next to the sink, clutching a small piece of paper with some handwritten notes. "Hi, guys. How are you?" My patient looked up and gave me the same sweet smile I had known for almost 10 years. Well on his way to manhood, he was slim and muscular, with a barely there line of fuzz on his upper lip. Always neatly put together, he wore freshly ironed khaki pants and a tucked-in white shirt. He'd let his usual crew cut grow out a little in the front, and I noticed a skillful upward sweep of pomaded bangs that I'd never seen before. His response was the typical one-word utterance that is the hallmark of teenage communication. "Hey," I smiled to myself, mentally filling in the first of many boxes. Language development appropriate? Check. I sat down on the little wheeled stool in front of the computer and reviewed his latest information. By then, it felt like I knew his chart by heart. It contained an ACE score of 7, symptoms of toxic stress, a history of successful interventions over the years when things flared up, and all of his most recent labs. The last time he came in, about a year ago, he had been in a great spot, physically and mentally. His asthma and eczema were under control, and he'd been doing well in school. He was even developing his first fledgling relationship with a girl. The toothy grins and laughter of childhood had given way to reluctant, though still boyish, smiles and a baritone voice. I could almost see the hormones coursing through his body. Though he had flashed me a reflexive smile when I first walked in, I knew when I looked at his mother that there was a concern. The expression on her face was as valuable as anything in the medical chart that day. Her brow was knit with the same mix of worry and hopefulness that I had come to know over the years. Something was going on. Fortunately, by now, Diego knew the drill. It was time for a tune-up. Like many of our patients with ACEs, he had gone through an initial period of intense therapy and other medical interventions when he first came to see us. We had successfully managed his asthma and eczema, and he'd resumed normal growth velocity, though he never completely made up for the years of growth he'd missed. As his primary medical home, we were there for every bump and scrape moving forward. Because the impacts of early adversity are chronic and long-lasting, rough patches are inevitable. That's something Diego and his mom had learned to take in stride. They understood that his stress response system was going to need a little TLC from time to time. Helping him navigate the medical services and therapies he needed was where I came in as his doctor. When I asked Diego what was up, he knew what I really meant was, if something is triggering your stress response, we've got to get on it early. Is there something going on that we can help with? Taking a deep breath, little Diego, who wasn't quite so little anymore, looked up at me. I don't know, he mumbled, and then looked at his mom. Doctora, Rosa began, smoothing out the crumpled piece of paper. Necesita su ayuda. He seems depressed. He's missing classes. His grades have gone to D's and F's. I know my son is struggling. He needs help. I looked at Diego. Is that right? He nodded sheepishly. I asked Rosa to step into the waiting room, and then I slid my stool over to Diego and rested my hand on the edge of the exam table. You want to tell me what's going on? It turned out the girl he had been seeing for the past year had problems of her own. She had been going through some family stuff, and it was taking a toll on their relationship. With her, it seemed like everything was up or down, on or off. Either their relationship was awesome, the best thing in her life, the thing that was saving her from everything else, or it was awful, and there was no way it could work out. A short time into their relationship, Diego found out that she was cutting herself. She didn't want him to make a big deal out of it. It was just something she did when things felt like they were too much. But Diego couldn't bear it. He wanted to protect her from her family and from herself.